All this week here on Now I've Heard Everything, I'm showcasing vintage interviews with authors whose books were made into movies that we love. Today, Michael Crichton talks about the real science and the very real ethical questions behind his 1990 bestseller, Jurassic Park. Now, I had read some of Michael Crichton's books before and certainly enjoyed the movie The Andromeda Strain, which is based on one of them, but I had never met or interviewed Michael Crichton until November 1990, when Jurassic Park was published.
In the early 80s, I became aware that there was some speculation about cloning dinosaurs, and the sort of amusing speculation that scientists entertained themselves with from time to time. And by the middle 80s, there were even some ideas about how exactly it might be done in terms of getting the DNA from insects in amber. And so I just sort of kept track of all this and eventually wrote the book. The idea of doing a dinosaur book is very pleasurable, you know. I mean, it's kind of about as much fun as something can be.
Well, you know, the day after I finished your book, I went and saw, was it Three Men and a Little Lady, I guess, and they're putting her to sleep, and the sheets and the pillowcases are all done up in dinosaurs. And it occurred to me, maybe one reason we love dinosaurs, especially kids, love dinosaurs so much is because they're so remote and distant, and they can't possibly hurt us now.
Yes, I think there is something to that. I mean, there's I'm not exactly sure why kids like them, but I think it has something to do with the largeness of them, the enormous size, and I think it has something also to do with the strangeness of the names. You know, I used to watch little girls of 3 and 4 go Stegosaurus, Triceratops, you know, and you could see there was some kind of pleasure in just saying the names. And I think also that the fact that they are distant makes them sort of fantasy creatures. I mean, you can think about them and with the freedom that you have because they're not coming back.
But, you know, the same thing that I find frightening about Robin Cook's medical thrillers is what I find frightening about The Andromeda Strain, Jurassic Park. Could this happen?
Well, something like it could happen. I mean, I don't think that we're going to have dinosaurs anytime soon, although you know, the whole history of biotechnology is it has gone a lot faster than people imagine. Molecular biology has gone faster. But I don't worry about it in a literal sense.
But the biotechnology community is much as you describe it in the book, isn't it? Isn't it far more interested in money and what we can do with these things that's fun than perhaps it should be?
Yes, I think so. I think no human activity is good without monitoring. I mean, you know, unless you're the kind of person who believes that school children will study without exams, unless you're the kind of person who believes that Wall Street doesn't need to be looked after and that the savings and loan disaster is just a kind of accident, biotechnology is a very powerful new technology. It's widespread. It's going on around the world. And somebody needs to be looking at it. I mean, somebody needs to be paying attention to it and bringing to light what it's doing. And at the moment, it's kind of free. I mean, in every sense of the word, it's no one's even noticing.
What do you call a book like this? Is it science fiction? Is it a techno thriller? Is it, what would you call it?
I'd call it it's certainly a thriller. I mean, it's certainly meant to be, my effort, or one of my efforts has been to make it compelling to read. And it's on a technical subject, so I guess a techno-thriller is okay. But a techno-thriller to me implies a sort of hardware book, and this is clearly not so much hardware. I mean, how can dinosaurs be hardware? And I think it's also true that I'm very interested in sort of philosophical questions, and I use the fast pace of the story to carry lots of things along that might not otherwise appear in a book like this.
How do you keep from weighing the story down with that kind of message? I mean, when you have somebody in here like Malcolm who wants to tell us what's really going on, mm-hmm. and try to put it into perspective from his point of view, how do you keep that from weighing down the pace of the story?
Well, I think it's trial and error. You know, I mean, you write it and then you see how much. I mean, if there are things you want to get in a book, you see how much it will bear before the branch breaks. And I don't know any other way to do it. I mean, it was my intent that the story have this other quality. And I'm also aware that I think people enjoy, so one of the things that people enjoy about my books is that there's often something to learn. So in this book, I really included a kind of primer on chaos theory, in part because I had a lot of friends who said, you know, I'm very interested in chaos theory and I can't figure it out at all. It's so complicated. And I thought, well, I can help you out. I'll put it in a book in easy to understand form.
But there again, now when your head is filled with knowledge, when you're in a specialized field and you want to put this knowledge into a novel, a story that's got to move quickly, it's got to have a pace. Mm-hmm. There again, you have to know where that balance is. You have to know how just enough information to put in, but not too much so it weighs down the story or bogs us down as we try to figure out what this word means.
I think it's a kind of instinct. I mean, it's. To me, it's just experiential, and I think I have a sort of feeling, you know, as I go along. I'm sure that all writers are like this, in that the first reader that they're working for is themselves, and so I, in writing, will have a certain sense of okay, I'm tired of this. This is enough of this, or this character has gone on long enough, and so I'll stop it. But and that may or may not be the point where the character stops in later drafts. I mean, one of the things that has to happen when you're giving a technical explanation in non-technical terms is that I find there's a tremendous need to rewrite for clarification. You just do it again and again to get it right.
I'm wondering if you have the same emotion as you're writing as we do when we're reading. You know, we appreciate the technical and we're fascinated by all that, but what we really want is for the bad guy to get one of the dinosaurs to get him in its jaws and just crunch him to pieces. When you're writing, can you not wait to get to that part?
Well, it depends. Now, some characters I'm very eager to get killed off, and I enjoy their deaths a lot, you know. And from time to time, you'll kill somebody, and then you'll read it later, and you think, no, it wasn't bad enough, and you go back. go back and give them a worse death, you know, stretch it out a little bit. But I don't think I'm by nature sadistic, so that I have a certain amount of discomfort about this. But there's pleasure. I mean, yes, absolutely. And in a book like this, people get munched. I mean, that's part of the fun of it. And I certainly enjoy doing it.
Well, what good would a dinosaur book be unless somebody got munched, right?
Absolutely. I mean, they're eaters.
I have to confess to a little bit, I experienced a little bit of discomfort when you introduced the children. I thought, I'm not sure that as a reader that I wanted to see children put in a story where I knew somebody was going to get crunched, because I wasn't sure what you were going to do with the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have misgivings about that?
No, not at all. Well, they're there for a couple of reasons. There's a sort of, I think, an obligation in the sense that our ideas about dinosaurs are all formed in childhood. I mean, you know, what we think about them is really relates back to early memories. I mean, most kids, their first trip to a museum, their first exposure to science, it's all dinosaurs. And I wanted to have the two kids have different views. So one of the kids is interested and is sort of an enthusiast, and the other one doesn't like it at all. So that was one thing. And the other reason, which is a sort of metaphorical reason, is that I think it's important to the extent that Jurassic Park is a parable about the real world, it's important to say, you know, that we are making a world for our children. And if you don't want to see kids in Jurassic Park, how do you feel about your own kids in this world that we're making now? Because that's what we're talking about ultimately.
Also, with the art of storytelling, I think one of the things I liked about the Andromeda Strain, one of the things I like about Jurassic Park, is that tiny little thread at the end that isn't quite woven back into the fabric and nice, neatly sewn up. You're wondering, well, what does happen next?
I think that's true to life.
That's true. Is it as much fun to write a book like this as it is to read it?
The one-word answer on this is no. This was a very, very difficult book to write, and I'm surprised that I'm pleased that people find it fun to read, but I was surprised when the first person that mentioned it said to me, boy, you must have just had a ball writing this. It was. Some books are easy and some books are hard. This one was hard for me, and I'm not sure why. You know, I mean, I have lots of different experiences in working, and sometimes the book just kind of pops out. You know, it's an easy delivery. It's fairly complete. It doesn't have to go through a lot of changes and revisions, and sometimes it's a protracted labor and it's agony all the way, and that's what this one was.
So. I also talk to a lot of novelists who fret endlessly about what Hollywood's going to do with their book when Hollywood gets its hands on it. Now, your book's already been sold. As I understand it, it's going to be there. Spielberg's going to be starting production next year on this.
Right.
Do you have misgivings? Do you wonder what's going to happen to it?
No. I mean, I think there are. I've done enough of this that I've had. I mean, I've certainly been in seen film versions of my books, and I've had to leave to try not to throw up. So I know what those feelings are like. Basically, it seems to me that the author's complaints about what Hollywood does are self-serving. I mean, if you don't want to sell the book, you don't have to. And if you do sell the book, something will happen to it in terms of its transformation. I'm writing the screenplay now, and it's quite startling what has to happen. In essence, 90% of the book must go. You know, and that's a kind of a funny problem when you think of it. I mean, you think 50%, okay, there's some fat, there's some things that can go. And to reduce the story to a bare fraction of its original structure is a big problem. And then the second problem is a realistic problem for films about a book like this. How are they going to make the dinosaurs? They have lots of technical issues. The animal can't do this, and you can't show that, and it's too expensive to do this. And the screenplay has to accommodate that.
See, that's where I appreciated the descriptions that you gave in here of the dinosaurs as being faster and more agile than we've been accustomed to seeing in these, you know, claymation-like movies right. of the past. That's our image of dinosaurs. I'm really going to be curious to see how they make nimble, quick dinosaurs.
Yes, I am too. But they certainly understand that's the goal, and they certainly, and particularly, I'm surprised that they're going to make so many of the animals full size. They're talking about a full scale, mechanical, two story high Tyrannosaurus Rex that can move, that can go 60 miles an hour. Now. And they can do really quick head movements. Stephen is very insistent that the animal be quick and have bird-like movements. It's going to be fantastic if they can do it.
Welcome to Jurassic Park.
Jurassic Park, the movie, was released in the summer of 1993, starring Sam Neill, Laura Dern, Jeff Goldblum. Made on an estimated budget of $63 million, Jurassic Park has earned some $1 billion worldwide. Author Michael Crichton died in 2008 at age 66. I'm Bill Thompson, and now I've heard everything.